Hey, it's Daryl Etherington, and I'm here with
Anthony Ha.
Literally here.
Yeah, it's
it's weird and uncomfortable.
We're here at TechCrunch Disrupt in San Francisco, which is the conference that we throw every year. And so every other episode of original content we've recorded where I'm in New York, Daryl's in Toronto, we're using Skype. Yeah. Now we're in this weird dark corner of the conference center looking into each other's eyes.
Yeah, sitting very closely together. So
partly because we have like one laptop with all the news we're going to talk about, so it's real close.
Yeah. So this is a bit of a special episode. It's a deviation from our normal format. Do you want to talk about what people can expect here?
Yeah. Well, it's basically, this is a gift to everyone who said that our episodes are too long.
Right.
Because we're going to do a roundup of the news, as usual, which is what we're recording now. We may talk a little bit about what we've been watching, although I don't think either of us has had much time.
Maybe what to look forward to, because it's basically unchanged from last week.
Right.
Yeah, it's been busy. We've been busy.
Or so we claim.
Yeah.
And then we're going to close out. We actually, at Disrupt, we were able to talk to Eric Berger, who's an executive at Crackle, and Ben Kitai, who's the creator of a show on Crackle called Startup. And so we're just going to close out the episode with those two interviews.
Yeah, so we recorded those previously, but we'll set them up, and then you guys can listen, and it's great.
It's a whole, like, backwards time travel episode.
Yeah, yeah, using the modern magic of science. So, you know, that's how that works.
Yep. Well, should we just launch into the news?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so the big headline, I think, is that Hulu's show, The Handmaid's Tale, won a bunch of Emmys, including Best Drama, Best Actress in a Drama Series, which is Elizabeth Moss. The creator, Bruce Miller, won for writing, they won for directing, they won for supporting actress. So it's like a whole bunch of awards, which I think, you know, it's just big news for Handmaid's Tale fans, but it's the first time a streaming service has won for Best Drama, and it's the first time Hulu's won an Emmy.
So. Yeah, yeah, it was a sweep. It was like, it was really good, and it was that was like the main streaming news out of the Emmys, right? Like Netflix also picked up a few things.
Yeah, so Netflix picked up some technical awards in terms of the big awards that were presented on Sunday night. They
Did
got
Amazon get anything?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, yeah, not. I'm not sure. They may have gotten some in the technical, what is called the Creative Arts Emmys.
Right, right.
Because like the Oscars, the Emmys has like have these weird names for the awards that I don't want to say no one cares about, but they're not going to attract the ratings of a general audience and putting them on.
Industry,
you know, TV.
Peers love those awards and respect them, and everybody is very happy when people get them.
Right, but they don't put them on TV.
Yeah.
And what Netflix got, I think, was they won a couple of awards for Black Mirror Season 3.
Okay.
Did you watch Black Mirror Season 3?
Yes, yeah, I did.
Yeah, so I think San Junipero won a couple of awards.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah, that was like, everybody loved that.
Right, because it was the only happy one.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 the only happy Black Mirror episode ever of all time, I think. Right?
I think that's correct, yeah. Essentially, I mean, it's not to spoil things too much, but it is the only one that would have what most people consider a happy ending.
Yeah, it's still not even like outright like, oh yeah, it makes us all feel good. You could have mixed feelings about it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And anyway, I think they would argue some of the negative, I think some people, maybe, I think probably the creators would say even the negative, the more darker episodes might have some happy stuff in them too. No, that's fair. and one of the things was in a lot of these categories, The Handmaid's Tale is going up against Stranger Things.
Oh, wow, okay.
And,
there was nothing really topped it this year in terms of like gravity and depth. And we were talking to one of our colleagues, I forget who. You remember? Somebody started watching it and was like, was it Henry?
Oh, I think it was Henry, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Henry, who's the best person working at TechCrunch.
Right, and I think the only person at TechCrunch who we know for sure listens regularly to the show.
Right, which is why we keep giving him shout-outs. So.
That's right, yeah.
But yeah, he was saying he like had started it and then it was like, because it's pretty heavy. I mean, it's heavy from the start and it only gets heavier, right? There are some good moments, there are some things to celebrate. In like, actually, a good comparison, not in terms of like theme or content, is like Mad Men.
Yeah.
Like Mad Men started out very, very dark and dismal, right? Like,
right.
It's a slog getting through.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing, but especially those first seasons.
Right. Exactly. That you sort of don't. It's not that the whole time you're like, this is a good show. This is a very good show.
Yeah.
But like,
but there's no relief. There's no like.
And when you finish an episode, you're not like, oh, let's go to the next one. You're like, I need to take a walk.
Yeah,
I need
to digest that. Yeah, 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 exactly. And that's what Handmaid's Tale was like for me too. But it was also like, nothing comes to mind that even came close to it in terms of being as sort of like important, as relevant, as like politically kind of appropriate for the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because we've seen some protesters now, like, don the costumes of The Handmaid's Tale to protest, you know, sort of anti-choice, anti-women, sort of misogynist policies, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. And it was, and I mean, it's, like, based on a you know, Margaret Atwood novel, and that's not exactly new, but I think their treatment of it, and then, like, just the time, it was the perfect combination.
Yeah, Margaret Atwood, a fellow Canadian.
That's right, exactly. Canadians do everything that is best.
I think we can all agree on that. Let me ask you something. Do you actually care about the Emmys?
No.
That's the thing, is I think there's this weird thing because of social media, maybe also being like journalists now, like you like that it seems more relevant, but I think for most people they don't really care. Like,
no, but I think it's like, I mean, well, it's always been sort of like it's... Any award show, right, is more about self-praise than it is about anything else, right? Like, an industry recognizing itself and, like...
Yeah.
They're about people enjoying themselves quite a bit, right? Especially, I mean, Crunchies. We had the Crunchy Awards. Those get that same kind of criticism, and I think it's deserved. But, like, yeah, with this, it's not like it directs any of my plans about what I'm going to watch or anything like that. I think for the... it's like your article said, or the reason your article exists is basically, you know, these accolades are coming for streaming services and it's a legitimization of the streaming service.
Right.
Right.
And I think that just what's interesting is how a few years ago the idea of somebody, like a big actor like Elizabeth Moss or Kevin Spacey for House of Cards doing a show on a streaming for service would have seemed very strange. Like, they were, like, slumming it.
Right.
And now it seems totally normal, and the fact that the best show on television by, you know, at least some measures is a streaming show seems totally normal. And if anything, it would probably, to me, seem weirder if the best show on television were on some, like, you know, NBC or ABC or something like that.
Yeah, right. That's changed so quickly. But, yeah, it definitely is that now, right? Like, I guess before streaming, it was like cable, right?
Right.
Like, the networks have been toothless for a long time, or perceived as toothless for a long time.
I think particularly on drama. I think on comedy, they're, you know, I think they've done better. But
if like Castle had won best drama, Castle's a great show. It's not on anymore, actually. I
think it's been canceled. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was just me thinking of Canadians again.
I think they were. I'm pretty sure I've never seen an episode of Castle, but as I understand it. They were originally talking about, because there's like two main actors, right? Nathan Fillion.
And Stana.
Katic.
Yeah.
And then they were going to do a season with Nathan Fillion, but not Stana.
Yeah, because she had left. Yeah.
Right. And then they were like, that's dumb. Let's just cancel the show. Because it went on for like 9 years.
I mean,
it's
Nathan Fillion could carry anything, though. So I think that would have been a great season of television.
I'm sure it would have been.
Other news?
Okay, other news. Next we have... Fox has this new show called Ghosted, and instead of just, you know, putting it on traditional TV, I mean, that's going to happen, but first, it's actually going to premiere on Twitter.
Right, yeah, and I've heard of this show before, and then starring Adam Scott and also...
Craig Robinson.
Craig Robinson, yeah, exactly. So good stars, good cast, a Twitter preview is not that unheard of or unprecedented, not for this, but like... not for Twitter specifically, but a lot of shows will do the iTunes preview.
Yeah,
or
iTunes,
the
YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, or it'll be available free on some kind of, like, purchase platform or whatever before it's even broadcast. So it's not that novel, but I guess it's a new thing for Twitter. And Twitter has tried to, like, refocus themselves as, you know, a streaming destination, specifically around, like, news and sports content, but... I guess this is maybe one of the first things they've done with more scripted content?
I think, yeah, certainly on this scale. I mean, I'm sure maybe there are some promotions, but I can't think of, like, another premiere of a network TV show that was first broadcast on Twitter.
No, yeah, me neither. And it's partially stunt. I don't know if anything comes out of it. Like you said, they're still going to broadcast it regularly on actual broadcast. It's not going to be shown on Twitter, I don't think, after the initial one, right?
Yeah. Oh, here we go. This is actually in our colleague Sarah Perez's article. Other networks, including TNT, Bravo, Showtime, and TBS, have done...
The same.
Yeah, like they sort of stream... Or they've streamed TV shows.
Yeah.
I mean, probably the most interesting one is the Samantha Bee not White House correspondent dinner.
Right.
Apparently they did that on Twitter.
So. But that's like, it's different. It's a different setup than this, which is like, we're going to premiere the show here. I mean, I guess if they get real, real good results, like that could become the destination of choice in future, depending on how the advertising arrangement shakes out. But right now, it's clearly just like, here's a show we think might resonate with Twitter's like demographic, which is what, older millennials maybe? Or like
yeah, essentially.
Gen Zennials. And then we'll like ship them back over to TV.
Right.
Hopefully get the eyeballs there where we still get the better advertising.
Yeah, by a long shot. And I mean, I do think there have been a lot of reports that Twitter is spending a lot of money on trying to get these kinds of video
right.
deals.
So maybe it's incentivized that way where they're like, also we're just getting a big payday from Twitter to do this.
Yeah. It makes me... I guess like what I still keep coming back to is to what extent people want to watch video on Twitter, and
right.
particularly longer video. Like I can understand like if it's a big game, and as all our regular listeners know, you and I love sports.
Yeah, we love the biggest game when it goes on. We're right there on Twitter tweeting along, watching the ball and stick.
Life tweeting the ball game.
Yeah, yeah.
But
saying like, why did he do the play?
But the idea is like, you know, okay, like I could imagine watching something for a minute, 5 minutes. I mean, I don't think there's any inherent reason why I couldn't watch a 30-minute or 60-minute show on Twitter.
Yeah.
I've never done it though, and it does seem like not the thing I go to Twitter for.
No, I mean maybe with some of their like apps, like the set-top box apps they've made, including the Apple TV app, are kind of interesting. Like they are a video first medium, right? And then it has like the live commentary
right.
that you can pop into if you want.
And that's part of it. They're going to have a Twitter Q&A.
Yeah.
But except it's not going to be while they're showing the episode. It's going to be
after the
episode ends.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, too. Because that's why it lends itself to live stuff, right? It's like you're commenting in the moment as something is happening with everybody else. Like, sports is a bad example for us, but I watch The Bachelor live as it's being aired. And
yeah.
then I watched the Twitter stream for that, right?
Right. But I can understand if it's an unscripted show where there's like a news or kind of like breaking
yeah.
news component, or actually like a real sports thing, except what didn't involve sports was like watching the Super Bowl and like when like Katy Perry was like having her show and like there's like
yeah, the
sharks, like the sharks started dancing and like that was like the greatest thing on Twitter.
That
like,
was good. It was a fun moment to be there.
Because everyone just in that moment was like immediately tuning like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Why is this happening?
Yeah.
So
yeah, but
it seems strange to do it after. I mean, I understand for like a scripted show. I mean, I definitely like when I'm watching shows for original content, I usually try to turn my phone off and so I don't like having distractions for stuff that's like scripted and you know, presumably has some creative merit versus
yeah.
just sort of like news or junk food.
Yeah, and that's it's like even the like the biggest like what a Big Bang Theory, I guess. I'm
right.
trying to think of like what is a big scripted show that a lot of people watch when it's live, like at the same
time. I think Game of Thrones is probably the most
Game of Thrones.
Example.
And Game of Thrones does have an active Twitter following, but
yeah.
also it sucks. Like if you're not also watching it, you don't want to be on Twitter
right.
while that's going on.
Yeah, there was.
Whereas with sports and news events, like who was saying? There was, like, a really funny anecdote I heard the other day where somebody was like, don't spoil it for me, like, the news. And it's like, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't actually spoil the news. It's just real life
right.
that's happening.
Right, right. You can't. People sometimes say, like, spoilers for real life, but, like, as a joke. Because
yeah.
it's already happened.
Yeah.
I think the one exception is probably, is again, sports, where I think if you haven't
watched
the game.
Some people do tape it and watch it, which is also
yeah.
weird to me.
But yeah.
Again,
but you
I don't
watch
understand
it the first
anything
time,
about it.
So.
Yeah.
I can understand the idea of like, okay, I've taped the game or you know DVR'd the game, and so I'm gonna
yeah.
watch it like when I get home. Don't tell me how it turned out. But
yeah.
other than that, like, I don't know. It seems like a
yeah, yeah. I think it's literally just like Adam Scott and Craig Robinson are probably people who like jokes on Twitter would also like. So let's just smash these things.
Yeah,
today.
We're probably overthinking it. I mean, I think that's really just an experiment, and
yeah.
like I think they're just like, let's if anything.
Do you know anything about the premise of the show at all?
Let's see.
Does Sarah's article tell us?
Let's see.
They
no,
probably
no.
are in a ghost house
There's
together.
Ghosts.
And
okay, so again, it's Ghosted, starring Greg Robinson, Adam Scott.
This is us like intuiting what the show is about based on the poster, the key art.
Yeah, because again, there's a post on TechCrunch, which I'm sure we'll link to, has a lot of details about some of the kind of business context for why Fox and Twitter would do this.
Yeah, yeah, which is the right focus.
Right. No information about the show whatsoever. Thanks
it's
a lot, Sarah.
Comedy. It's a comedy.
Yeah, I mean, it's Well, I think, I mean,
guess it's not going to be a hard-hitting drama starring
probably,
Kurt Robinson and Adam Scott.
Yeah. But I wonder if this will, because in a past episode you're saying, you know, Adam Scott might become like the Adam Sandler of Netflix, just doing like
right,
a bunch
which
of
I feel like if he heard that, he'll never speak to us ever again.
But. Yeah, yeah. We got some interesting feedback on that, which we probably shouldn't talk about yet. Maybe in the future we can talk about it in more detail.
Yeah.
But I don't know if this is, you know, maybe he's going on a different path.
Yeah.
Different path.
Yeah.
Well, since we have no idea what this show is actually
let's
about.
Let's move on. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah. Next, we have a Hulu news story. So this was interesting a couple of months ago. Bo Willimon, who was the showrunner of House of Cards, which I'm sure all of our listeners know, the first big streaming hit, the first big hit for Netflix, he is going over to Hulu and doing a show called The First.
Right.
And that's already been announced, but they announced that now that Sean Penn is going to be starring in it.
Wow. Okay. And it's a space drama.
It's a space drama?
Starring Sean Penn.
Yeah.
That's like, I don't know, already that's enough to make me wary.
Just because he doesn't seem like a guy who belongs in space?
Yeah, I don't know. All my recent memories of Sean Penn are around him and his journalistic...
Right, going interviewing El Chapo.
Yeah, his interview of El Chapo. But it's like... And then I'm just picturing that Sean Penn, the Sean Penn that's the voice of that article, which
right.
was, if you haven't read it, please go do read that article.
Yeah, it's good. It's you know, it's long.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But him doing that, but in space. So it's not a good fit.
You know what I think of Sean Penn now is there was a summer where I was like, I guess this was basically before, this was like 10 years ago now, before I'd like become a journalist essentially. And I had this internship at this small town newspaper. And like, so I was just on the road a lot.
Yeah.
And I was listening to the audiobook for the Bob Dylan memoir, Chronicles, and Sean Penn did the voice for that. So I just think of that, so I think it was just Sean Penn as the voice of the 60s, you know? And then like telling us what it was like to, you know, meet the great stars and countercultural icons of the 60s. So that's Sean Penn for me.
Well, I mean, that also doesn't fit with the
But space. maybe it's going to be a very different kind of space show, right? In the same
yeah.
way that, like, I think in the 90s, when you and I were lads, space was Star Trek, The Next Generation, and all the shows that were trying to be like Star Trek,
yeah.
The Next Generation, or like Babylon 5 a little later. But then with, like, Battlestar Galactica, and now with... The Expanse.
The Expanse, yeah, that's what I was thinking of, is like maybe a direct comparable to
right.
this.
Right, and so they're a little bit more, I mean, it's a totally overused word, but like a little more gritty, a little bit more grounded, and they don't have, so you can imagine a more sort of realistic
yeah.
kind of contemporary actor like Sean Penn fitting in.
Yeah, yeah, I could. That's weird, actually. This is a bit of a tangent, but it's like, it's kind of like Star Wars has become the primary influencing thing for that again, right? Like, there's a realism.
Oh. Yeah, I think
that's
true.
There's like a dirty world quality to it.
Right. Although, I mean,
they're darker. They're not like as...
Yeah, although, I mean, I think it's sort of hard to separate, because, like, I think Battlestar Galactica is probably one of the main templates.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
Battlestar Galactica was, the new version was created by Ron Moore, who
right.
worked on Star Trek, and I think... Part of him doing Battlestar Galactica was being like, okay, I'm gonna do all the things that they wouldn't let me do on Star Trek.
Oh, okay.
And so in that way, it's still a Star Trek influence, even if it's...
just a response to the other stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can make anything set in space and not be thinking about Star Wars to
no.
some extent.
Yeah, that's true. Do you know any of the plot details of this thing?
Yeah, it takes place on Mars. It's like the first human mission to Mars. It's gonna focus on the astronauts, and also like the ground team back on Earth. So I mean,
oh,
in some ways,
oh.
kind of like the
so
Martian.
So much more near future.
Yeah, 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 it's not like.
So this makes a lot of sense, actually.
you take it all back.
I can see it more in something like that. That makes it more sense to me.
Right. But I mean, I guess also like if you imagine like, I don't know, this is maybe not quite what it's gonna be, but like a House of Cards in space.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh,
I can
God.
Imagine a Sean Penn like doing that.
I hope
that.
It's not like that.
How do you do the House of Cards?
Well, this is I get in fights about this all the time, because I have not really watched House of Cards.
Okay.
Except for the first episode.
Okay. And listen, I've been on podcasts where I trash talk shows after watching one episode, so that's fine.
Yeah, well, and I didn't watch the whole first episode.
So you watched 5 minutes.
I watched 5 minutes. I literally watched until, like, the Sean Penn, like, turns and talks to the camera after
Kevin
killing
Spacey.
The dog, whatever his stupid name is. Yes, one of those Kevin Spacey.
White guys in their 50s or 60s.
Yeah. So he, like, what does he do? He kills the dog and then he turns, spoilers, right, for the first 5 minutes of the first episode, in
right,
case you were worried about that. But, and then he, like, narrates him, like, why did I kill this dog? I'm just a cool president. And I was like, nope, bye-bye forever.
Listen, like, that was, he did that, like, after, you know, coming off of performing Richard III. It's a whole, it's like a, you know, it's a theatrical device.
Yeah, I mean, it was. English it was major. A clumsy theatrical device.
I would say that House of Cards, for me, if you try to watch it as a serious show about politics, you will not like it. If you watch it as if it was basically Gossip Girl set in Washington, D.C. with middle-aged people.
But isn't that Scandal, but better? Scandal is better.
I think a lot of people think Scandal. I mean, I remember there was like an article around that time that was like, even though Scandal superficially seems like the less serious show, it's actually a lot better.
Yeah. See? I don't know. I have trouble with it. Tara, my girlfriend, loves it and watches all of it. And like particularly argues, she's always like, yeah, but Robin Wright is so great in it, like, go for that. Oh, weird. That's a weird pen connection that we've just
drawn. Oh, yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. She's
what
free
does it
of
mean?
Now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I mean, I'll give it another chance, but
yeah,
depending on this, maybe I'll watch, this is closer to my interests, since
right,
I don't love politics, but I do like space.
Right. I guess, I mean, the other thing is just the fact that, so when Bo Willimon left House of Cards, it was after, I think, 4 years, and there was sort of this thing of like, oh, he wants to go write plays,
right,
was with the reason they gave, which, I mean, of course, whenever anyone leaves something, there's always a layer of bullshit about
yeah,
why that's happening. And then very quickly, he was announced doing a show for Hulu instead, so that clearly was not
no,
what
yeah,
was actually
he
going on.
He already made the deal.
Yeah, and I think there has been some discussion about whether Netflix is, the market's getting more competitive.
Yeah.
And like that Netflix,
can they retain their top talent when
right,
everybody's outgunning for them?
Right, and that I think, you know, when House of Cards premiered, there was like, they made such a big deal about like the fact that Netflix essentially was like, here's $100 million, go make 2 seasons of this show. We'll see you in a year.
Yeah.
And I think they tend to be a lot more hands-on now.
Yeah.
You have to like go through a more traditional Hollywood process of like working with executives.
And some of the other ones can be a little more creator focused.
Right.
Which actually, I mean, you'll hear in the interview later, but that was one of the things Ben had said, right? Was that
right,
they were very, yeah, Crackle. They were
yeah,
very like, go nuts, do whatever you want. Right?
Yeah.
That's a good segue though, because like there was another talent shift
mm-hmm,
for the Stranger Things writer, whose name is Justin Doble, which I just read off the article I wrote. But yeah, so he was a writer and producer on Stranger Things, not the creator of the show,
right?
But key writer, and he has like a bunch of other cool writing credits to his name, including Fringe, which is like where
oh,
he started
cool,
out his career.
Nice.
And a couple other places, but I don't remember what they are. But he's like now signed an exclusive deal with Amazon Studios to produce television content, television series. So.
Yeah.
That's another thing where it was like, you know, there's probably lots of poaching going on. There's his face. We're looking at it right here. But yeah, it's, you know, there's the talent war heating up, and it's gonna extend down. It's not just gonna be for the creators. It's gonna be for any key personnel
right,
involved in it. Right?
But I think, I guess the other thing it makes me think of is, again, a couple of weeks ago, there were these reports that Jeff Bezos was shaking up Amazon strategy, and he said, you
bring
know,
me my Game of Thrones.
Yeah, and he's like, enough of like, why do we have 2 different shows about F. Scott Fitzgerald?
I'll say
like,
that
doesn't make any sense. we haven't seen these shows. Maybe they're amazing.
Was there a shared universe? Was
no,
it a cinematic
no, well,
F.
And,
Scott Fitzgerald universe?
And again, one of them was about him and his wife, and primarily about Zelda. Mm-hmm. One of them was an adaptation of one of his books.
Oh, okay.
But it still seems a little
it's
going
very,
all in on.
Yeah. We know what the kids want these days. That's Scott.
So, like, he was like Game of Thrones, but obviously one of the other big recent hits is Stranger Things. So, but I think, you know, the Duffer brothers, who are the creators
yeah,
of Stranger Things, I don't think are leaving Netflix anytime soon.
No.
I'm sure, like, Netflix is like paying them crazy amounts of money.
Yeah, they're probably locked down. And well, I mean, they're locked down. They're committed to at least a couple more seasons of Stranger Things.
Right.
And then, yeah, I mean, that extends out for a while. But this guy is probably free and available. Like, not under such tight constraints in terms of contract requirements. And still probably a big creative force involved in, like, just Stranger Things season
right,
one success, right?
Well, it's interesting because I think now there's this tendency also to, like, I think, again, like, 20 years ago, like, no one knew who created TV shows. I mean, with some exceptions, like, everyone knew Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek, you know, Rod Serling created Twilight Zone, but other than that, you really didn't know.
Well, they, like, would put their name right on the title card or whatever.
Right.
So that you knew.
Or if you're, yeah, with Rod Serling, he would narrate the episode.
Yeah.
But in general, you didn't know, and now I think everyone knows who the showrunner is and the creator, but you don't necessarily know who writes, like, every individual episode.
Yeah.
And so I think stepping up from being a staff writer to, like, actually creating shows is still, like, a really, probably, you know, really exciting career move, too.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, and he did have the producer credit, too. Like, he was involved pretty, you know, throughout. But, I mean, I just think it's a great trend to watch. Like, I never have really paid attention to, like, that kind of thing, like showrunner talent acquisitions or whatever. But now I'm paying a lot more attention, and it's very interesting just seeing what people worked on before and what they're working on next.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, too, because, like, you can't, like it's also something that we see. I mean, obviously, the amounts of money involved are probably much smaller, but, like, in comic books. But, like, if you're a comic book writer, you can write two or three, you know, series at once, depending on how fast you are.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, if you're really involved in the day-to-day of a TV show, you can really only do one at once.
Yeah.
So, like, even though you sign this deal, it really does, he may just only make one show as a result of the deal.
Right, yeah. Or he could just move up to a very high-level showrunner position and then, like, be more liminally involved with a bunch of things, right?
Right, like Shonda Rhimes with all the Shondaland shows where I think the degree of involvement kind of changes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's, the comic books thing is funny because you get, like, you just see these, like, you know, so it is, it's totally a so-and-so is hot, so hot right now, and then you just see them on, like, every book for, like, at least a year or two.
Right.
Jeff Lemire was everywhere.
Right.
That was another Canadian. I just wanted to get more Canadian.
No, that's fair. I mean, I think it's also, there's, like, a publicity aspect, and then there's, I guess it's, like, getting other creators to take notice and say, oh, this is a place where, like, you can have a really good deal. It's worth going and, pitching my, like, high profile, potentially really promising stuff there.
Yeah. So is that the news?
That's the news.
That's the news. Wow. This is going to be a real short episode. People are not going to know what to do with their time.
They just have to listen to it twice. Actually, listen to it backwards. And there's a hidden message.
Listen to it at half speed is also, because then we threw some stuff in there in between real, real fast.
Yeah.
And you'll hear what the secret message is.
It's a satanic prayer. Yeah. Oh, I guess I gave the secret
Don't give it away.
So have you been watching anything since we recorded our last episode?
No, because of Disrupt. Disrupt has ruined all for me. It's, like, such a big deal. We prepare so hard for it, so.
I did watch two more episodes of American Vandal while I was flying over. That was the last time I had time to watch anything.
Uh-huh.
And you were right. It gets a lot better.
Yeah.
But it was also funny because as I was watching it and as our episode hit, that was also when it was becoming available to the general public. And I remember, I think there were a lot of people who were just like, how is this an 8-episode series?
Yes, that was like, I saw that reaction everywhere, right? But it's good. Stick with it if you haven't yet and you haven't listened to our spoiler late an episode. Like, stick with it. It gets good.
Yeah, I was spoiled. You spoiled it for me, and I didn't bother.
You told me.
I probably came out a little angrier than I realized. I think I was maybe more unhappy about that than I'm admitting to myself. But even so, it was still a lot of fun, even though I was spoiled for it. It's not really a plot. It's weird because it's a mystery, but it's not really a plot-driven show.
No, but it has the aspects of, like, a procedural or something, right?
Yeah.
Also, we've made a lot of our own original content, so if people haven't seen some of the stuff from Disrupt, go watch that. That's something to watch. We've watched that because we've been in it.
I don't know how I feel about this Disrupt plug. And so I think instead of talking about stuff we've seen, because we've seen nothing, essentially, next week we're gonna be reviewing the first episode of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, because that's coming out on September 24th.
That's right.
And this is super exciting because we haven't had Christmas Day ruined for us because it's no advance copies, right?
They did. I will tell you that I emailed CBS and said, hey, like, can we get a screener? And they said, because of security reasons, and again, there have been all these hacks and things like that, is understandable. They're like, no, we can't, but if you want, we're having, they didn't say the premiere, they said a premiere event is happening in LA if you want to come, but it's during Disrupt.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen it, and I'm furious.
Yeah, and I just saw people, like, talking about how they weren't releasing screeners ahead of time to media, so it'll be exciting. I'm super excited about it. I mean, how could you not be, right? First new Star Trek show in
More than a decade.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the first one with a black woman as the star. There's definitely been a lot of behind the scenes drama about like Brian Fuller was originally going to be the showrunner and he left, and so we'll see how it actually
could turn out very poorly, but hopefully it doesn't. All right, so we're going to leave you with interviews now. So instead of the review, we're gonna kick to some interviews that we did on site here at Disrupt. I think we'll lead with the.
Ben Kitai, who again is the creator of Startup, is a show on Crackle. The first season aired last year, and it was sort of about this fake cryptocurrency. Yeah. And now I think in the second season, which is about to premiere, they are, I think, maybe that's still involved, but I think they're expanding to sort of other aspects of like the darknet. So it's, I think that when people hear this, this show is called Startup, and frankly, I think that's what we thought at first. It was going to be essentially a Silicon Valley ripoff.
Yeah.
But it's, I think it's much different, like much more like a crime.
It sounds like a crime show.
Show involving like tech.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also, because we haven't seen it. Either of us haven't seen it. We will watch it.
I was dancing around that. Yeah.
And there's also Ron Perlman is in it.
In season two,
In season two. So that's the big star addition is Ron Perlman. But Martin Freeman was already in it.
Yeah. But I think they also,
and Adrian Brody. It's like crazy cast, actually.
But, yeah. And they were at Disrupt, and they even had a booth where they were like promoting their cryptocurrency.
Yeah, as if it was a real cryptocurrency.
Right. They really messed with our attendees, which is good.
Yeah. But they were also doing some research, I think, on the lowdown.
So we talked to, I mean, both of these interviews are just a few minutes long, but we talked to Ben about, you know, Startup and sort of the experience of working with Crackle, and then you talked to Eric Berger.
Yeah, Eric Berger, who is EVP, Executive Vice President of Digital, and the General Manager over at Crackle, which is wholly owned by Sony Pictures Television, but it's them doing streaming and ad-supported streaming. So.
I'm extremely skeptical that last segment is gonna the audio is gonna be okay on that.
Oh, it'll be fine, and this is gonna be in it too because I'm not doing any edits on this.
Yeah, you guys could probably hear some background noise because we're actually at Disrupt.
Yeah, we're actually here live, and that's what's exciting about being live. But we had a good chat about kind of Crackle and what they've been doing with original content because they started way back in 2012 with their first original show. And a bit about consoles and where they have their audience and how they see their audience, and it was actually pretty interesting to me because I'm not super familiar with Crackle's business and
one of the interesting things this is probably just illustrating that I'm an idiot, but I hadn't connected the dots that they're talking about how Crackle has a big presence on consoles, and part of that of course is because they're owned by Sony, which makes the PlayStation.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was
pre-installed on PlayStation. Yeah, but it was funny because he did very specifically say consoles. He never once said one or the other.
Right. And I don't think it's just that their audience is on PlayStation, but I mean that's an undeniable advantage that they have.
Yeah.
Synergy, sure. It's a beautiful thing.
Oh yeah. Can't get better. All right, I think that's about it for us. We're going to go find out what this weird horn noise was here at Disrupt. And Anthony's going to go on stage soon.
I am, but when you listen to this, I will have already been on stage because we are talking to you from the past.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it works. We'll never get around it. Maybe one day we'll record it live. No.
Yeah, why not? I feel like we could.
We could.
Maybe we'll get them to do it at Disrupt.
Yeah, next Disrupt. Look out for that. It's a promise.
That's definitely not a promise. All right, have a good week, guys. Hi, I'm here with Ben Kitai, the creator of Startup, a program on Crackle. The first season of Startup aired last year, and you're about to premiere the second season. We'll get into that in just a second. But for people who haven't seen the show, what is Startup about?
Startup is about the collision of tech and crime in the city of Miami. We explore the themes of the American dream and what it means to start from nothing and innovate and create using 21st century technology, which at times, in times of desperation, can sometimes mean using dirty money or other sort of nefarious methods of trying to get your company either funded or launched or marketed. And so we're exploring all of those things. It touches on the tech community in Miami, but also on the criminal community in Miami, from money launderers to Haitian gangsters and Russian mobsters and beyond. So,
how much of this is based on real world research versus your own creativity?
An astonishing amount, actually. We you know, there was a lot of stuff where it was sort of like, all right, we might have to stretch the truth here. But then after doing research, we were like, oh, really? That actually happens. And so we tried to, you know, we tried to keep things as realistic as possible. We took some liberties here and there, obviously, just to make the story more exciting, make certain twists and turns work better. And even from the tech perspective, you know, the tech isn't necessarily 100% sound or, you know, GenCoin. There's no real GenCoin. There's no real algorithm for GenCoin. But we really, what we wanted to do was embrace more so the culture surrounding the tech community and the crime community, and bringing those two things together.
So you have this amazing cast led by Martin Freeman. How did you get them involved?
Just sort of the old-fashioned way, you know, send the script, have a conversation about the character, and, you know, Martin responded right away. He was really into the idea of playing somebody much more kind of a much darker character than he's used to playing. He had been looking to do something like that, and we really hit it off when we were talking about where to take the character and just sort of the kind of the tectonic plates that exist inside this man. And so yeah, Martin came aboard very early on. Adam Brody, Eddie Gathegi, Omar Morero, they all kind of fell in line right behind him. And then in season two, we had a new character that we needed, somebody that had just as much weight as a Martin Freeman to come in and play. And so same experience with Ron Perlman. He really responded to the material. Luckily, he was our first choice, so it was actually really easy.
And so I know season one was focused on this cryptocurrency called GenCoin. As I understand it, season two, the sort of tech focus is going to expand beyond that. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we didn't want to keep things confined just to cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is a really cool thing to talk about in theory, but it's kind of a difficult thing to dramatize season in, season out. And so we wanted to start exploring or expanding into different realms of tech. And the new frontier, not that the dark net is a new thing, but there is a brewing sort of kind of revolution in what it means to be a part of the dark net, not just the community, but on the side of people that are trying to create or foment a new dark net outside the reaches of the U.S. government, who created Tor, which a lot of people don't actually know, and try to create something that brings back the idea of privacy on the internet, democracy on the internet, and get rid of all the kind of corporatization and the government interference and start anew. And so that's what we really lean into this season, is seeing our characters come together to try to create that. And how do you start that from the ground up?
And so the show, as we mentioned, is on Crackle. What has the experience been like working with Crackle, and how do you think that compares if you've gone through a more traditional network?
Well, the great thing about Crackle is, you know, unlike the traditional networks, they are very filmmaker driven. They're very, they take a lot of big chances. They like to just, you know, they like to tell stories that may not necessarily be for everybody, but really kind of hang their hat on the fact that we get great casts, get great talent to work on the show. And they let the filmmakers really tell the kind of story they want to tell and shoot it the way they want to shoot it. So there's a lot more creative freedom, a lot more kind of edge to the projects that they do at Crackle. And so I think that's why this was a really good home for the show. I think it would have been, if we had done it like NBC or something like that, it would have been much more kind of pasteurized.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone watch Startup on Crackle.
Yeah, absolutely do that. Thank you so much. That's great.
Hey, it's Daryl. I'm here with Eric Berger, Executive Vice President of Digital and General Manager at Crackle. So let's talk a bit about Crackle and original content. You guys have actually been in the original content business for quite a while now.
We have. It's been quite a while. We've started off as web series, and then we've been doing some movies, and now we are in the drama business with shows like Startup.
Great. Can you talk a bit about that strategy and how it evolved?
We think of ourselves as a program network, and we're programmed for an audience that lives a lot on consoles, PlayStation and Xbox, but also streaming devices like Apple TV and Roku and Amazon Fire, and sort of a young male sensibility. And so we license content and program content that are movies and TV shows, and then we layer those originals on top of it. So we want the originals to really represent the brand that we are aiming for with this audience, and to sort of excite and energize that audience as well. And we found that moving upstream into these longer form dramas and movies and very high professional quality content is very differentiated for a streaming service that is free and ad supported.
Right.
So that is our model. And so you typically don't see this kind of programming slate or sensibility on those types of services.
No, you don't. And that's interesting too. Is it like, you know, Crackle, you mentioned video game consoles, like has a big presence on video game consoles. So are you seeing the demographics kind of mature towards wanting that drama?
Absolutely. We always say we have a sort of mature millennial audience. So these are people 25 to 35. And there's a misconception in many markets about what that gamer audience is or what that profile is, that it's guys in a basement and, you know, but it's not. These are people. They're married. They're in long-term relationships. They've got professional jobs.
They are, in fact, human beings.
They're homeowners. They're actually human beings that are out in the world, and they are consumers of products and are an amazing audience for advertisers to reach, and a very hard audience for advertisers to reach, and are very loyal to that game console device and everything that's on it. And so we've just found that it's a great market for us, and that free is differentiated from what's out there. And that's always been our model, and we're just very committed to that.
Great. And what about a bit more about your forward-thinking strategy? Is original content something you want to explore more in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. The world is clearly exploding with original content out there, and we just feel like we've really found our audience, and the more true to that audience that we are in connecting that type of content to them.
So it's not going to be a scattershot approach. You're still going to go.
It's very specific in what we're creating and who we're creating it for. And we're going to continue to do that and increase the slate that you'll be seeing coming from us.
And just, we were talking to
Ben
from Startup earlier.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that he had previously created Chosen for you guys. So is that something you look at? You know, you find creators, you like working with them?
We did. We found. That's such a... We were lucky enough to work with Ben on Chosen, which was a really fantastic show. We did a couple of seasons of that. It's Milo Ventimiglia, who's so big right now on his current show. But we just really loved his sensibility and the way that he both wrote and directed and the pacing and how he worked with actors. And so we found this project, Startup, and we were hoping and lucky enough to get Ben to come on board with that.
Great. And also, just, are you seeing Crackle's approach change? Are you still committed to consoles, or what kind of devices, what kind of opportunities do you see there?
So we're on every device that there is.
Yep.
The largest concentration of users are on, and the most engaged users are on game consoles, so PlayStation and Xbox, but more than 70% of our consumption happens in the living room on streaming devices in general.
Oh, okay.
So the other streaming boxes and the smart TVs that are out there. It is a more lean back experience than not, as it is with a lot of the over-the-top streaming services that are there right now. And that's really where we're committed to. We're also in 21 countries right now, so we're in Latin America and Canada. And
that's a differentiator too, because a lot of things are not necessarily available in all markets.
That's right. So we're at least on the Western Hemisphere for now.
Yeah. Great. All right. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate it.